Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up in today's show, Mary Trump on her explosive new book, which lifts the lid on who she calls her weak and narcissistic uncle, Donald Trump. Colm Tobin will talk about his memories of Italia 90 and protecting Eamon Dunphy from angry fans. Writer Cathy McMahon's latest novel about grief and long-term love. And Mike Scott will play the latest song from the Waterboys. Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. You can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Call. Well, Kathleen McMahon is one of our most popular novelists. Her first novel, This Is How It Ends, was a runaway bestseller. And her latest, Nothing But Blue Sky, is the story of a long married couple, David and Mary Rose. And Kathleen joins me now. Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning.
The novel begins with a death. What happens?
It's the story of a marriage, but it's the story of a marriage told backwards, which kind of interested me, because traditionally with a relationship, you take it from the beginning and the marriage is the end, you know, and you live happily ever after. And I'm interested in marriage anyway. And the happily ever after as a concept seems to me so... I should point out I'm really happily married myself.
I was going to say.
Lest my husband is listening. But it seems to me a really big ask, you know, it's quite a proposition that you would take two people and throw them together and alakazam, you know, you're one.
Yeah, and forever.
Yeah. And but I wanted to look at that backwards because I think a marriage is never really, there's never really a verdict on a marriage. The jury is always out. So I wanted to take this marriage from where it ends with the death of Mary Rose and have her husband be forced to kind of reevaluate it and rethink it and relive what bits about it he still doesn't understand. And that to me was really interesting. You know, there's a line in the book, one of the characters says, we live life forwards, we learn it backwards. Mm. And I think that's true the more I think about it. So in this novel, I take that backwards learning view of the marriage. And, you know, all those assumptions people make when they get married. You know, you meet somebody, sometimes who you hardly even know, and you stand up in a registry office or on the altar of a church, and you make these assumptions. You know, in this case, with the novel, Mary Rose has assumed that they'll have children, and she has her life mapped out along the lines of the children and grandchildren. And David has made really more general assumptions, but because she's such a happy person, I think he's assumed that she'll always be happy and that nothing will ever derail her. And that's not true. And he begins to understand that. He certainly never expected that she'd die.
Such a good idea. Where did you come up with this idea?
You know, bereavement was on my mind and grief was on my mind. My mum died nearly 10 years ago. My aunt died. And since then, I lost three really close friends to cancer. All women. I don't know, in my life, the tragedies that seem to have happened in recent years are all women, young mums, cancer, largely. All different in their way. But certainly that grief really comes to inhabit you and you experience it. And if you're a writer, that becomes interesting. And I was interested in grief and the different ways people respond to it. The experience of grief really made me interested in our reactions to it, how different people react in different ways. After my Aunt Caroline died, people said all sorts of things to me.
But your Aunt Caroline Walsh.
Caroline Walsh, who died suddenly and really tragically. And she was, you know, a huge person in our family. And I was terribly close to her. And she was also very well known. She was an editor in the Irish Times. So lots of people in the journalism and books business knew her. So, you know, for that couple of years, you'd go out and people would say things to you. But there was one thing somebody said that really stuck in my mind. A colleague of mine stopped me one day and sympathised over Caroline's death. And I told this colleague that what really troubled me about it was the shadow it would cast over the future in our family. That the weddings, the babies, the happy occasions. And I think I told her that there wouldn't be any happy occasions. That this was such a sad thing to happen in our family and her absence was going to be so heartbreaking for us that things would be spoiled. And this colleague really, really wisely and really gently said to me, I know what you're saying, but I hope you don't mind me telling you, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And she had had a tragedy in her family where a nephew had been killed in very, very sad circumstances. And she said, there will always be a moment when you think of the person on the wedding, the birth of the baby, the birthday parties. But actually, they will be happy occasions because that's how we live.
And she was right, of course.
And she's 100% right. And I think that was something that was really at the heart of this story I wanted to tell.
Of course, your grandmother was a celebrated writer, Mary Lavin. Did that put pressure on you when you started to write, or did it encourage you to be a writer? Because for people listening this morning, lots of people want to write that novel, want to write something, and yet they think it's too late or they can't start. But you actually changed your career.
Yeah, I think actually what happened with me is unusual in that I spent a very long time trying not to be a writer because of grandmother. And not because her reputation. I mean, people always think, well, were you intimidated by her reputation? I mean, she was very well known and, you know, a wonderful, wonderful writer. But when you're in a family, you don't really see that, you know. And kids, especially kids, aren't interested in what their parents do or what their grandparents do. So to me, she was grandmother. So the problem was much more her persona. You know, she wasn't an easy person. And that kind of attached itself in my mind to her profession. She was very chaotic. I think one of her stories has an incident which is probably based on her biography of her going through her paperwork on a train and getting fed up and throwing it all out the window. And that's what she was like, you know. And as a child, you see the personality. So I'm in the back of the car leaving her house, and I would have absorbed what my mum was saying and what my aunts were saying, which would have been quite a lot of exasperation. You know, she was a difficult person in the family, quite chaotic. Very loving as a granny. But, you know, my other grandmother scrubbed her steps with bleach and had fruitcakes in tins. And Mary Lavin did not bake, you know, and was quite disruptive. So I think in a way I ran in the other direction. My father's side of the family were all engineers, and I thought therein lies the path of sanity. And, you know, you'll be easier to live with. I didn't do engineering, but I certainly would have been very wary of being a writer in terms of the behaviour that I connected with it. So now I try to kind of be a writer and behave like an engineer.
Thankfully, you did become a writer because you've been hugely successful. I loved your new book, Nothing But Blue Sky by you, Kathy McMahon, is published by Penguin and well worth reading. Thanks so much for being my guest this morning.
Now for some music. Well, the Waterboys are one of the most beloved bands this country has ever produced. And although frontman Mike Scott is Scottish, we claimed him a long time ago. I don't need to remind you of their songs down the years, but their new single is out now, and a new album, the band's 14th, called Good Luck Seeker, will be out on the 21st of August. And I'm now joined by Mike Scott. Morning, Mike.
Hello, Miriam. Good morning to you.
Listen, we're going to play your new single, The Soul Singer, in a moment. But I read that this new album, it was created almost by accident, wasn't it? You were just having fun in your home studio.
Yes, just busy making fun for myself in my studio. And suddenly I realised, hang on, I've got an album's worth of stuff here. A bit like that. Crept up on me.
Which is fab. I mean, and in terms of, you know, social distancing and all that, did it make it all the more complicated with a studio and a recording? How did that work?
Well, I have my home studio here in Dublin. Well, I call it a home studio. It's a couple of streets from where I live. And I go there every day and I've always got something going on there. I'm always working on something. And with the technology these days, the rest of the band can send me their stuff by email.
That's really useful, actually. And of course, the fabulous fiddle playing of Steve Wickham. How long have you two been working together? Decades, isn't it?
Yeah, we've known each other for 35 years.
Wow. And it's a real creative bond between the two of you, isn't it?
Ah, yes, it is. And it's a versatile, musically versatile bond. You know, we're not limited. We can both play all kinds of music. He can do his fuzz fiddle Jimi Hendrix thing, but he can also play very lyrically, and he can play country western. And I like that, being able to move between musical styles.
There's lots of beautiful songs in the album. One of the songs, you know, that you've written lyrics to, it's an instrumental organ piece by the great Padraig O'Riordan. It's lovely that. Mm.
That's called The Land of Sunset. Yes, Padraig very kindly gave me permission to use his piece of music. It's a very beautiful piece of music. It's one of Ireland's greatest composers.
Definitely, like his father.
Like his dad, yeah.
And also I read somewhere, but this could be wrong, Mike, that this album, it's a bit of a spiritual journey for you. Is it? And if so, in what way?
Well, the second half of the album which is all the spoken word pieces, they are kind of explorations. It's philosophical, I would say, rather than spiritual. The first half of the album is all songs, I think seven songs of different styles, different feelings. And then the second half is all these spoken word pieces with me reciting over music, which is very good fun. It's quite a different job. It's a different discipline.
Interesting. And of course, is it with Tomás Magón on your classic song, The Stolen Child, your fans That's will remember. Right. But was it a meeting with Dylan, Bob Dylan in 86, which inspired you to try it for yourself?
Well, I hung out with Dylan once in a hotel, and just when I was going away, he gave me this cassette. He said, I think you'll like this. And it was a cassette by an American Indian poet called John Trudell. And I took it away and I listened to it. And Bob was right. I did like it. I liked the way Trudell cast his spoken word pieces over rock and roll music and over blues music. And I learned a lot from listening to Trudell. So thanks to Bob for that one.
What was Bob Dylan like?
He was very funny, Miriam. He had a sparkle in his eye, mischievous.
That's lovely to hear, actually.
Yeah.
And supportive, obviously, to another artist. You also cover a Kate Bush song, Why Should I Love You, from, I think, her Red Shoes album, which she collaborated on Prince with, I think. What kind of an influence has Kate had on you, and why this song?
You know, I love Kate's music, but I've never bought one of her albums except the one that one was on, which was, you're quite right, it's the Red Shoes. And I loved that album. It was a breakup album and full of a kind of very beautiful pain. Kate was very good at that. And I loved that song particularly, which you're right again, Prince collaborated on it. He did guitar, backing vocals, keyboards. I think we used a few of his licks in our version.
You know, when you write a new song, Mike, and you release a new album, I mean, do you feel the same sense of excitement, for instance, you felt when you released, say, Fisherman's Blues? Is it as exciting?
It's different, Miriam, because I'm an older hand. So it's the future is less unknown than it was when I was in my 20s. So in that sense, it's less exciting. But in the sense of I've got new music that I love and I want to get it out to people, that's still very exciting.
And you took part, didn't you, in an online listening party, I think, at the Classic Water Boys album, This Is The Sea. How does something like that work? I gather it was Tim Burgess of The Chardons that ran it, is that right?
Yes, they're called Tim's Twitter Listening Parties. And what happens is he began it on the first night of the lockdown in the UK, which I think was the 23rd of March. And everybody listens to an album and they all start at the same time, 9 o'clock, for example, which is when we did the This Is The Sea one on Sunday night. So everybody presses play on their streaming or their vinyl or their CD, whatever they're listening on. And we all tweet about it in real time while listening to it.
It's really interesting.
A nice communal experience.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I couldn't type fast enough to get the information out.
Now, your new single, The Soul Singer, it features the vocals of the fabulous Jess Kavanagh.
Yes.
Really fabulous. It's been described as pop and roll. How would you describe it before we listen to it?
Oh, it's a horn-driven stomper. It's great to dance to.
That'll do. Okay, I recommend people get up and dance to it. As ever, Mike Scott, thanks for chatting to me this morning. And we hear now your new song from the Waterboys, The Soul Singer, and it's from your forthcoming album, Good Luck Seeker, which is coming out on the 21st of August. Mind yourself, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Miriam. Same to you.
Take care.
Away with being rude, cause everyone's scared of his quicksilver moods. The soul singer, he's been around for 50 years. Every crease of his face is a souvenir. The soul singer, he's seen it all, made every move. Dude's got next to nothing left to prove. Climb to the top, been through the ringer. Ladies and gentlemen, the soul singer.
likes to grumble, loves to scoff about all the cats who ripped him off, the soul singer.
Great new single from their forthcoming album, Good Luck Seeker, which is coming out on the 21st of August. Well, just before we take a break, I want to pay tribute this morning to Ruth Morrissey, who died this week from cervical cancer. What an extraordinary woman she was. Courageous to the very end of her life, she won her case against the HSE and two laboratories. And as a result of her bravery, more than 200 women learned that they were affected by incorrect smear test results. She leaves behind her heartbroken family. I was lucky and privileged enough to speak to Ruth last year on this programme. I asked her what kept her going, and she had described her husband Paul as her rock during the interview, but I asked her about her daughter Libby.
Oh God, you talk about a rock. I don't know whether I want to call her. She's amazing. I mean, she just from every part, from her head to her toe, and I'm always saying to her, who's my, how much do I love you? And she's like, to infinity and beyond, and she's my best friend, and you know, and she's like,
how old is she?
She's 7 and a half. Very important.
Yeah.
She'll be 8 in July. You know, she keeps us going. You know, we're a family unit of three. Three of us love each other very, very much. We do everything together, going to the cinema, walks, movies, trying to get her to go to Toman Park as much as we possibly can. So we were kind of hoping to go to Ariana Grande, obviously, but we missed out on the tickets, so that was going to be our first concert, so we kind of sourced three tickets for that in September, so hopefully that's on our radar. But no, we're fantastic, the three of us together. She's amazing. Everything about her, you know, we were told, you know, back when she was born that she wasn't going to make, because Libby actually had a left diaphragmatic hernia. So she was actually born in Dublin, so we flag her saying she's a dove every time Leinster and Munster are playing, you have to leave the room. And so we were told she wouldn't survive, and given very minimal chance with her. So she did, and she was home within 10 days after her repair. So she's a wonderful human being in person. So she keeps us going. She really does.
The wonderful, irreplaceable Ruth Morrissey, who died this week from cervical cancer. And they did get to go to the Ariana Grande concert, which was great. And our thoughts this morning are with Libby and Paul and all of the loved ones of Ruth Kulosov. We'll take a break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, we of course lost a great hero recently, Jack Charlton, an Englishman who brought joy to our Irish hearts. And we remember Italian 90 when Jack's army moved en masse around Italy to support the boys in green. There's also an unlikely person, not a football fan, but one of our greatest ever writers, Colm Tobin, who was there in Italy following the fans around and being tasked as Eamon Dunphy's bodyguard. Good morning, Colm Tobin.
Miriam, how are you?
Okay, explain more to me about this.
Well, Inga Spanning asked me to go and cover the fans in Italia 90, just not to write about the game because that was what the experts were doing, but simply to write about the atmosphere. So I went pretty early and I wrote about the places. I went to Cagliari, I went to Palermo, and it was really all very nice. And I didn't, obviously, you know, what happened to those of us who were in Italy all the time is we missed what was happening in Ireland. And one of the things that happened in Ireland was that Eamon Dunphy really got into a rage over the tactics of the Irish team, matters I didn't really fully understand. And eventually it was decided, you know, he threw a pencil or something on television at night and in Ireland. And eventually it was decided he was going to come to Palermo and he was going to see a game in Palermo. And I was very excited about this because I'd been on my own for a long time wandering around. I thought it'd be great. There were some great restaurants and things to see. But when Eamon arrived, he was in a different sort of mood. He wasn't interested in restaurants or things to see. He really had an issue with the way the team were playing, and he wanted to raise this matter in public with Jack Charlton at a press conference. And Angus Fanning, I had to file in copy all the time, and Angus Fanning, who was the editor of the Sunday Independent, got me on the phone and said, "Colm, I have a problem. We have a problem. And you've really got to get involved in this," which is that we just don't know what the response of the fans will be to Eamon, since it's being alleged that he said he was ashamed to be Irish or he was ashamed of the Irish team. And we just don't know what's going to happen. And we think we don't want him ever to be left alone I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, just always stay with him. I said, yeah, but if anything, and just be with him. I said, yeah, but what if I, and then I said, Angus, if anything happens, I'm going to run. Like, don't, like, I mean, just think about me. I'm a wimp. You know, I'm not actually going to be able to do anything for him other than maybe run and get help. He said, no, always stay with him. And he kept saying to me, always stay with him. So in any case, I therefore was my job. I appear in Jack's autobiography, in Jack Charlton's book, as a little man in green who was always with Eamon Dunphy. So at least I, you know, had an alibi that Jack says I was with Eamon. And in fact, the fans didn't read. I mean, there were maybe moments where there were we certain. I think Eamon's memory of this is different to mine. I remember things being pretty benign, and I think Eamon remembers something else, but. What was interesting was that on the first day at the press conference, as soon as Eamon stood up to speak, Jack said, if you're speaking, I'm leaving. And so this, you know, contretemps began that Jack would not stay in the press conference if Eamon was there. And Eamon made a decision that he wasn't going to make this into a circus. He could have easily gone to press conference after press conference, disrupting each one. But actually, he just did the first one. And after that, he stayed away. And he came and we went together to the match in Rome, and he was all the time thinking about the technical matters to do with football. And of course, I really couldn't work this out. I mean, I thought, well, hold on, we're winning, we're doing well. I mean, the team, there's a huge amount of excitement. But Eamon really felt that there was a technical matter to do with actually the game itself. And he was a great believer in the game itself. And we'd met, we were sort of an unlikely pairing, Eamon and me, in the sense that we really had nothing whatsoever in common, except we liked each other. And so so part of my Italian 90 was really, I was the official bodyguard for
Eamon Dunphy. And actually, you two, one of the reasons I'm speaking to you this morning, Colm, is you and Eamon are going to be reunited online, of course, as part of this year's Galway International Arts Festival to remember Italia 90. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really strange that it's 30 years ago because, of course, I'm 65 now. So when I think of 30 years in the future, well, I would be 95. So, you know, it doesn't seem that long ago. And yet we have to agree that
you'll be a great 95-year-old, Colm.
It was 30 years, but it was. I mean, the actually to witness what happened and to see the way that say that things that we didn't, you know, people said the Irish fans behaved impeccably, and it wasn't just that. It was a sense of the pleasure people took in the game and the aftermath of the game. There was a marvelous night in Genoa. When you know we had won against Romania, and the Italians had won a game that day as well. I mean, not in Genoa, but elsewhere. Which meant the Italians came out onto the streets of Genoa, and the Irish and the Italians mixed, and people went to bars. There was a wonderful moment in I think it was in Cagliari, where the Italian police discovered the Baron, and yeah. I just couldn't understand the amount of noise that this thing could make. The Italian police also discovered, I think, very early on that the Irish fans would do anything except cause trouble, you know. And so it was an absolutely marvelous occasion. And in Rome, it was added to by the fact that, you know, a plane load of Irish people came, including Liam Hamilton and Charlie Haughey. And, you know, it was a great occasion. Eamon, however, was saying, I'm a professional journalist. You guys are fans. There's some journalists who he would call fans with typewriters. But and he had no time for fans with typewriters.
I gather you bumped into Charlie Haughey, and you'd been writing, of course, very critically of him, hadn't you, in McGill column. Remind me what happened in the embassy.
I've been writing critically about Charlie in the Sunday Indo and just sort of mocking him generally. But there was a reception in the ambassador to the Vatican's house, I think. And I was standing there and I was keeping away from Charlie. You know, I mean, there was no point in raining on his parade that day. And but Tommy Gorman decided it was time to bring Charlie and me together and have us facing each other. And I couldn't think what to say to him. So I said to him, isn't it marvelous the luxury we have these ambassadors living in? And he said, yes, some of the Irish buildings are very beautiful. The one in Paris is one of the most. And he went on, droned on, boring me badly over how beautiful the building in Paris was. And that's saying a great deal because it's, you know. And then he said, you know, I was responsible for buying that building in Paris. And I was attacked at the time by people like you. And he pointed his finger at me. So that was a sort of an end to, I mean, the all the bonhomie of Italia 90 did not stretch to that encounter. Charlie Hoy, he still had it. He still was feeling over some stupid thing I'd written about him.
Calm as ever, thank you so much for joining us this morning to chat to us.
Thank you very much, Miriam. Thank you.
And Colm Tobin, alongside Eamon Dunphy, will be taking part in a First Thought talk just called Italia 90 later in the year in September as part of Galway International Arts Festival's autumn activity. Full details will be announced in early August on www.giaf.ie for all the details.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, a narcissist, weak, a fragile ego, a tax fraud, a bully. These are just some of the labels Mary Trump assigns to her uncle Donald Trump in her new memoir. It's a book the White House desperately tried to stop. But since publication this month, the book Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, has become a bestseller. And Mary Trump joins me now from New York. Good morning, Mary. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Listen, let's go back to the beginning and talk about your father, Fred Trump Jr. Obviously, he was Donald's older brother, the son of Fred Trump Sr., the founder of the Trump family, millions in real estate. You really feel at the heart of everything you write, don't you, Mary, that your dad was very badly treated in the family?
Yes, he was, from a very young age. As the oldest son, and namesake, my dad was also the heir apparent to my grandfather's empire. And, you know, it's impossible to know exactly when this happened, but certainly by the time my father was a teenager, my grandfather realized that he wasn't the person he wanted his oldest son and namesake to be. Mm. You know, he wanted a killer. He wanted a tough guy. He wanted somebody who would do anything to win. One of my grandfather's philosophies was that life and family was a zero-sum game and only one person could win. And if you weren't winning, you were losing. So my father did not fit that bill. You know, he was a kind, sensitive boy and man who, you know, he loved being outside. He had interests outside of the family business. He had a group of friends who adored him. And he was punished mightily for that, you know, and Donald witnessed that punishment and humiliation and learned from a very young age that in order to succeed in the family and in life, he could be nothing like his older brother.
Now, your Uncle Donald, I think he has said, hasn't he, Mary, that he regrets the pressure he put on your dad. I think he's on the record saying that.
Yeah, he is. You know, whether that's deeply felt or not, I don't know. But one thing I take offense to, because the way Donald couches that is he says that, you know, my dad wasn't good at real estate and they should have just let him go do what he loved. But there's no evidence to suggest that my dad was bad at real estate. The truth of the matter is he had every intention of working for my grandfather and taking the empire over someday. But my grandfather, who had already rendered his verdict about his oldest son's character, just kind of refused to give him any opportunities. By the same token, there's absolutely no evidence that Donald was good at real estate.
And you say it all really is learned behavior from Fred Sr., your granddad, that's what Donald learned. And you call your granddad a sociopath. Is that a fair representation of him?
I believe it is. You know, it's part of it is just having experienced him as somebody who has an extremely narrow range of human emotion. You know, if you met him, you would think he's cheerful, he's competent, but, you know, he had every reason to be those things because he was in total control of his family and his business. But beyond that, he was very intimidating. He had no use for frivolity or people who didn't believe the way he believed. And, you know, if we just look at his children and how they turned out, you know, he had five children and every single one of them in one way or another turned out to be a deeply damaged human being. You know, it would be one thing if it were just one out of the five, but it's all five of them. And that's remarkable. And I also saw firsthand how he treated my father as he got sicker. You know, he had open heart surgery when he was 39 and was never able to stop drinking or smoking. And instead of helping him, my grandfather just continued to humiliate him. And towards the end, when my dad was so sick, he had to live with his parents again. My grandfather put him on a maintenance crew at the company my father was supposed to run.
And you watched your granddad, didn't you, Mary? I think mock your dad. And you also saw Donald learn to ridicule your dad as almost a way of ingratiating himself with his own father.
Yeah, and that's one of the most lasting damages my grandfather committed. I mean, he pitted his children against each other. So they could never really be allies. You know, they were really isolated, just not just from the world, but from each other growing up. And that was very cruel.
Your dad, he became a pilot very young, a really successful pilot. He really didn't at that stage want to take over the family business. Is that why his father pushed him aside, that he saw him as weak in some way?
Well, actually, my dad joined Trump Management, my grandfather's real estate company, right out of college, and tried his best to be the person my grandfather was going to lean on and delegate responsibility to. But my grandfather never did it. He never afforded my father any respect. He made life in the office for him miserable. You know, he would give him petty tasks to do. You know, he would like manage maintenance and stuff like that. And when my dad did try to do something significant to further the company's interest, my grandfather would just completely blow up at him and humiliate him in front of people who, technically speaking, one day would have been my father's employees. So, you know, after 3.5 years of torment, my dad just couldn't take it anymore. And, you know, he was already an excellent pilot and airlines had ended an 8-year moratorium on hiring. So they desperately needed pilots to start flying their jets, which had just been introduced into the fleets. He applied to TWA and he made it on the first shot, which in any other family would have been considered an extraordinary achievement. My grandfather, however, considered it a betrayal, and he told my father repeatedly that he was nothing but a glorified bus driver.
Now, your dad, as you've written about and most people know, he became an alcoholic. I mean, sometimes, and this may sound harsh, Mary, I suppose sometimes some children are trickier than other children. Are you saying that you think if your dad had been treated differently by his own father, that he would not have become an alcoholic?
You know, that's impossible to say because like many, many illnesses, alcoholism has a genetic component. Mm-hmm. So that his drinking may have become a problem regardless. I do know that his drinking was out of control precisely at this moment. Like that's when his real problem with drinking started, when he was flying for TWA. You know, stressors are very often triggers and, you know, alcoholism, schizophrenia. So although it's difficult to say, I also do feel that my father would have had a much better chance if he had had a family that supported him and loved him.
Yeah, you painted as a really harsh, unforgiving environment. You described softness was unthinkable. What do you mean by that?
As I mentioned earlier, my dad was a very sensitive person. He took things to heart. His father's criticism really affected him. And my grandfather saw that as weakness, you know. He thought that acknowledging a mistake was weakness, apologizing was a weakness, you know, and I think we can see from the way Donald behaves that he learned that lesson too.
Before we discuss Donald again, your dad died. He died tragically at 42 with, is it right, no family members around him, Mary?
That's right.
How did that happen?
This was in 1981. So, you know, that's back in the day when people only had landlines. So my aunt Marianne and my uncle Robert couldn't be reached. So that's why they weren't there. They just had no idea what was happening. But when my Aunt Elizabeth and Donald got to my grandparents' house, my dad had already been taken to a hospital that nobody in my family had anything to do with, which is remarkable because my grandparents had donated millions of dollars to a Jamaica hospital and had been such big supporters that a wing was actually named after my grandmother. You know, they'd given so much money to the hospital that they were very connected there. They knew everybody there. So the fact that they allowed my dad to be taken to some anonymous hospital in Jamaica, Queens was striking. So when Donald and Elizabeth got to my grandparents' house, my grandparents were just sitting in the library waiting for the phone to ring. So I think part of it was just following my grandfather's lead, which is what everybody in the family always did. He wasn't going to the hospital. Donald and Elizabeth weren't going to go to the hospital. What makes it worse, though, is that Donald and Elizabeth went to the movies.
Knowing how ill your father was.
Well, he died just a few hours after the ambulance came and got him. So they must have known. The hospital must have told them. And in fact, I know they did because Donald called my mom to tell her that my dad was very ill and it didn't look like he was going to make it. So he knew that.
You were 16, I think, only Mary. That must have stored up, I don't know, a lot of hurt even back then, way before court cases over money. Mm-hmm. That must have made you very hurt, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it was devastating to lose him. You know, it was also incredibly complicated because his illness had made it very difficult for us to have a good relationship. You know, he could be extremely hard to deal with, honestly. So I felt a lot of guilt after he died as well. I felt like I should have tried harder. But also after he died, I didn't, with the exception of, you know, seeing them at holidays, I never got a phone call or a letter from any of my aunts or uncles or either of my grandparents.
You have a doctorate in clinical psychology and you describe your uncle Donald as having all the classic characteristics of a narcissist. Mm-hmm. What are they?
You know, intense self-regard, sort of delusions about one's own capabilities. He ticks off all nine of the symptoms that are laid out in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which I believe is predominantly used in America. I think Europe has a different version of it, but you know, his desperate need for attention, to be the center of attention. So, you know, I wasn't interested in diagnosing him because I think his diagnosis is irrelevant. We have to deal with his behavior. You know, we have to deal with the fact that he seems incapable of changing or improving in any way. So I was more interested in giving people an understanding of the psychological landscape and just pointing to potential symptoms that could explain, help people explain his behaviors. So as I mentioned in the prologue to the book, it's much more complicated than just saying he's a narcissist. You know, there's so much else going on. His psychopathologies are enormously complex. And, you know, to some degree, beyond our reach, because he won't seek treatment. And nobody around him will suggest that he do.
You do say also in the book, though, Mary, that your uncle Donald, that he did have a spark of kindness.
Yeah, you know, I think this has been a long project, you know, to for my grandfather to get Donald to be the person that he required him to be in order to be of use to him, which is why, you know, I don't think that Donald was a born sociopath in the way I believe my grandfather probably was. You know, there were a couple of instances of kindness that I witnessed, you know, nothing out of the ordinary, truly. And the only reason they stand out is because they were so few and far between. But yeah, I do think that that impulse was there, but it eventually got beaten out of him. And I honestly, I don't think it exists anymore.
I mean, of course, critics have said, Mary, you've heard it a lot, that really you're a disgruntled, disinherited niece, that the big split mm-hmm. with your family came, I suppose, when you and your brother were effectively disinherited by your granddad's will, a long and upsetting legal battle followed. And what would you say when they say this is really just about you wanting to make money and you're disgruntled and disinherited?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's kind of fascinating that people think I've been playing that long a game. You know, there was no way for me to know that we were going to end up here. I'm neither disgruntled nor bitter, nor and it certainly wasn't my goal to cash in. But what's interesting to me, first of all, about those kinds of statements is that I was legitimately deceived and defrauded by my family. So it's not like I'm just making this up and, you know, I just wanted more. You know, my aunts and uncles, who were also my trustees and should have had my fiduciary interest, you know, in mind when they were, you know, taking care of my finances, they cooked the book, so to speak, you know, to speak in colloquially, to make sure that I didn't get my fair share of properties I already owned. And I'm not talking about my grandfather's will. My grandfather had every right to disinherit me. I'm talking about the partnerships I was involved in. So, you know, I mean, some people might say it's revenge, but I'd say if I were looking to right that wrong, it would be more justice. But that having been said, if I had just been looking to score some bit of revenge or score a payday, I would have done this 10 years ago when it was he was a very public figure. And it would have been safer. You know, people outside of America may not be as aware of this, but whistleblowers have fared very poorly in this administration. They've lost their jobs. Their reputations have been stained. Their reputations have suffered. Some people have been forced to resign early, and you know, not to mention death threats from Donald's fanatical base.
Sorry for cutting across, Mary. Though, you did go and accept an invitation to the White House in 2017. Why did you go? And when you were there, you also said to him, don't let them get you down. I mean, did you mean that at the time? And why did you visit the White House?
Families are enormously complicated. And it's really hard at one stroke to learn you've been disinherited and to learn that you've lost your family. Because in my family, money was the only currency. It stood in for everything else. Love, affection, respect. So to be disinherited was to be told quite emphatically that you're not loved and you don't matter. So when my Aunt Marianne sort of extended an olive branch after my cousin Ivanka's wedding, you know, I was eager to accept it. And we developed what I thought was a quite good relationship. And I went to the White House because it was to celebrate her birthday and my other aunt's birthday. You know, I wasn't going there to score points or to take advantage of anything. She invited me to her birthday party, and I wanted to go. And also, it's important to keep in mind that this was only, it was less than 4 months into the administration. And although I didn't support him, and I knew that it was going to be a disaster because he was ill-equipped to fill the role, you know, it was still early days, and there was no clear indication yet just how enabled he was going to be and just how bad it was going to get.
Okay. And Mary, I know you say you've mainly written this book because you're worried about America. You don't want him to win in November, but you've paid a huge price. There was already a rift with your wider family. But now, in a sense, I know your only sibling, your brother, is not happy with the book. You liked your Aunt Marianne, and now there's a rift. Was it too big a price to pay, do you think, to lose those connections with your family?
You know, I would completely understand if Marianne were not interested in ever speaking to me again. I think that's fair. But I'm not closing any doors. So, you know, this will play out as it has to. And honestly, this was something I needed to do. This was my decision. It had nothing to do with anybody else. And I don't fault anybody for how they feel one way or the other.
Final question. The New York Times review, you've read it yourself. It says about your book that it was written from pain and designed to hurt. Would you accept that?
It was definitely written from pain. Writing this book was one of the most difficult things I've ever done in my life. It was not at all designed to hurt. I'm not saying that it won't. And I think that's unfortunate, but I was committed to tell the truth. I believe that this is a foundational story about, most importantly, how Donald became who he is. And my primary reason for writing it was to help people understand what it means to have him in the position he's in and to give them as much information going forward so they can make much more informed decisions this November than they could possibly have made in November 2016.
Final question. Have you heard anything from him since you wrote the book? And do you think you will ever hear from Donald Trump again?
I have not, and I do not believe I ever will. And that's okay.
Okay, listen, Mary Trump, thanks so much for joining us. Your book, Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, is published by Simon Schuster. And as I said, it's a huge bestseller. Thank you for being my guest this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it from us for today. The show was produced by Shana Gorman. Thank you all very much for listening. Until then, have a lovely Sunday and slán.